When the recession hit in 2008, we heard a lot of talk from world financial leaders about how capitalism as we know it has come to an end, and our political leaders were all running around trying to prove that capitalism is still a viable economic system. And now, 3 years later, in our current provincial election here, we don't hear any of that sort of talk, and I'm sure it's similar in Ontario where you live. Did capitalism, global capitalism, did it fundamentally change during the recent recession?
Well, it changed in this respect, that we entered into a period of crisis that is far from over, and although the mainstream got through their initial panic when they were literally frightened that the whole global financial system was going to collapse, what we're now seeing is that the problems were pushed off, and they were pushed off by a massive bailout of the banking system undertaken by government-run central banks that pumped something like about $27 trillion into rescuing the economy, or about twice what the U.S. economy produces in 1 year. Twice that was just thrown into the banking system and to stimulate the economy. So they sort of staved off the first phase of the crisis when banks were collapsing, all five investment banks on Wall Street, banks in Ireland, Germany, Spain, England, they all were collapsing. They staved that off with a huge global bailout. And then they breathed a sigh of relief and tried to tell us that everything was fine once again with capitalism. Now, all of a sudden, we're back into a scenario in which it looks like banks in Europe may start to collapse again, in which unemployment is rising massively in countries like Ireland, Spain, Greece. I mean, just to give you the example of Spain, the official adult unemployment rate is over 21%, and the youth unemployment rate is 45%. And that's the official government figure. So you're talking about a depression-level situation. All of those economies have slid back into recession now. The U.S. economy cannot generate jobs. There are fewer people working by millions today, 3 years after the crisis started in the U.S., than there were in 2008. Yet, of course, the population has grown by millions in the meantime. So what's happened is that they kind of bought some time by bailing out the banking system, but now they're trying to figure out how you pay the bills for that bailout. And that's where we get into this very dangerous scenario where they've decided, well, the average citizen who had to foot the bill to bail out the banks is now going to pay for that bailout by way of so-called austerity, which is to say massive cuts to social programs. We're seeing the worst of it in parts of the U.S. and Europe, but it's pretty much a global phenomenon right now. And I think, interestingly, what it's doing is it's posing some of the same question marks about the long-term viability of capitalism that emerged in 2008. A lot of people were questioning at that point. And then they thought, okay, crisis over, panic over. I think we're back into that same scenario, both of some panic and some questioning.
We're heading back into recession. Most of the media pundits seem to be proclaiming at this point. At this stage, do the world economies have fewer tools at their disposal for dealing with that crisis?
In many ways, they do. Now, I'm not saying they can't figure out some short-run scenarios to prevent a massive banking collapse in Europe in the next few months, for instance. I think they probably could figure it out. I'm not sure they will. They could make a real botch of it. We have to remember they don't always get their act together and they don't always read the tea leaves very well. But they might muddle through for some months. But yes, in terms of your fundamental question, they have spent so much in terms of public funds, public wealth, in that first big round of bank bailouts that they're having a harder time selling government debt. And that's how governments raise money. They sell you a debt. They sell you the equivalent of an IOU. And they say, give us money today, and over the next 5 years or 10 years, whatever that debt instrument says, we will pay you back with interest. Okay? But now, more and more large financial institutions are looking at that government debt, particularly of Greece or Ireland or Portugal or Spain, but even increasingly the U.S., and saying, we don't know how much capacity they have to pay back. It's not infinite. Sooner or later, these governments are taking on so much debt that we doubt their ability to repay, and then they'll default on these loans, and then we'll be holding essentially worthless paper and taking huge multi-million or multi-billion, in some case, losses. So that constrains what governments can do now. Financial markets, the big hedge funds, private investment institutions, global banks, they're getting gun-shy about that government debt. And so it is going to make it more difficult, not impossible for them to have short-term interventions, but in terms of a really sustained reigniting of the economy, yeah, I think they're in trouble there.
Often we think of crises as opportunities for the left, and particularly in the Marxist tradition, you look at capitalism building its own grave diggers. I remember when the recession hit in 2008, there didn't seem to be a lot of organized reaction from the radical left or the left generally. Did we miss an opportunity at that point?
Yes and no. And I say that because obviously I wish the radical left could have gotten its act together in a more significant and substantial way and made a larger contribution both to the understanding of this crisis by way of popular education and so on, and also in terms of building resistance movements. So that's the yes, we missed it side. But the no side is that there has been sufficiently strong resistance in parts of the world that I think, if I can put it in these terms, symbols of resistance and examples of resistance have emerged. If you take not only the waves of general strikes that have happened in Europe, but if you take the youth rebellions where tens of thousands of young people were occupying city squares in Spain and Greece, just camping out and holding them. If you look at the enormous student-led upheaval in Chile right now, which has now sparked general strikes and sometimes 600,000 people in the streets around the slogan, "Our future is not for sale." If you look at the interconnected uprisings of young people, unemployed citizens, and workers in Tunisia and Egypt that overthrew dictatorships, I think we can say that for the failures of the left, which are real, it remains the case that there have been examples of popular resistance that can serve as inspirations. And so it's a kind of glass half full, glass half empty scenario right now. I think there are real dangers and challenges for those of us who want to see really transformative political movements develop that look beyond capitalism to a new kind of future for humankind. There are real dangers for us in this moment that we're not taking advantage, as you say, of a crisis as opportunity. But I think as well there are also openings. There are places where hundreds of thousands and occasionally millions of people are going into motion and into resistance and creating new political movements, new mass assembly style, democracy in the city squares, and so on. And I think that could become, some of those movements could become points of inspiration as well, because we need to remind ourselves that even if we didn't get our act together well enough in the first couple of years, if we're looking, as many people think, at a generation of crisis, that this is going to last 10, 20 years, this period, then there will be more opportunities if we can figure out how to speak in a meaningful way to large sections of the population and to begin to organize new resistance movements that also raise up the vision of a new society, a transformed society.
Last time you were here in Winnipeg, it was still winter here, but the phrase that was starting to be used was Arab Spring. And you're speaking about the role of labor movements within those rebellions that swept across North Africa. Mm-hmm. Did the labor movement in those countries, is it still a powerful force? And are those rebellions still functioning as progressive movements in those areas?
My answer to that is yes. And I say that not to discount the fact that it's a very complicated political terrain. There are a lot of different forces in countries like Tunisia and Egypt that are kind of jockeying for position. And sometimes the best organized ones are the ones that in one way or another want to stop the process of social change, whether it's the old guard, political movements like Mubarak's old party in Egypt, whether it's groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who will talk about change, but in fact are deeply conservative. So those are obstacles to this process of revolutionary change in those societies continuing. But having said that, take Egypt as a case in point, the independent trade union movement is growing and moving forward. Earlier this week, teachers launched their first strike since the 1950s. It's big, growing, powerful teacher strike, and as all these strikes have been in the post-Mubarak era in Egypt, they're not just about wages and working conditions. They're demanding fundamental transformation of the institutions. They're saying that the education ministry has to weed out all the old guard, that it has to become accountable to the population, that education has to answer to social needs, and so on. So I think that, not to underestimate how complicated and complex the political terrain is, those movements are struggling to move forward. New left coalitions are being created as well, bringing together a number of anti-capitalist groups. They're talking about standing candidates in elections, not because they think they're going to win electoral office, but because they see elections as a good way of getting their message out, managing to disseminate a lot of their vision for a very different kind of Egypt where working people's interests would come first. So I think there is still a lot of hope there, which is not to be just naively optimistic, but I think because so much of the media sees the big players on the scene, they often miss what's happening at the grassroots level. And grassroots is a growing and more militant independent labor movement in Egypt, which is very promising.
Finally, you mentioned that we could be facing a generation of crisis and possibly a generation of austerity, paying off these large debts that the public sector has generated over the past few years. What should working people and left organizers be doing right now to prepare for resisting those kinds of austerity measures?
Well, I'm going to really just offer some ideas because I don't claim to have all the answers in that regard, but I've been fortunate to do a lot of traveling over the last year or so, to be in conversations with activists from Madison, Wisconsin, to people literally on the streets in Cairo. And so I think I've picked up some basic ideas. And I would say some of the following. We need the popular education that I was referring to earlier, where we get a different understanding of this crisis, what's causing it, and what the prospects are for most working class people out there. And so the kind of conversation that we're having in alternative media is one part of that story. Secondly, trying to bring together grassroots resistance organizations wherever it's possible, in communities, in trade unions, and so on. In Toronto, we've got the Stop the Cuts Network, which is doing grassroots organizing right in neighborhoods. They're bringing people together, doing neighborhood-based organizing, and then moving on to protests at City Hall, just as one case in point. And then thirdly, I think the radical anti-capitalist activists out there have to, in a certain sense, step up to the plate and say, you know what? The past number of years, it was okay to kind of just do our own thing. And if we work together occasionally, that's fine. But I think now we have a responsibility to sort of get together and say, can we build larger coalitions of anti-capitalist forces? I'll just give you one example. In Toronto, something has come together called the Greater Toronto Workers' Assembly. It has anarchists and socialists, people from the labor movement, people from migrant justice movement, people from environmental backgrounds, and so on. I don't know how well it will do, but it's an example, I think, of a model of saying, as an anti-capitalist left, it's time for us to try to really figure out how to work together. That will allow us both to get some of our messages out there, but also to be part of the movement building in a more coherent, more collective, more collaborative way. So I put my emphasis on those three things.
Well, thanks so much. Always inspiring.
Thanks, Josh. I really appreciate it.